This is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
Yeah, welcome to the Christian War Room, and welcome to another session here. We are looking at what happens if a country, a nation, is not embracing God anymore. It's not willing to listen to God anymore, just giving up on God. What happens if a nation is giving up on God? And we've had a couple of examples in history, and the worst thing, which I think is that people don't take it to heart anymore. People don't look at history. They don't look what happened in the past. They don't maybe interpret history with different eyes. And so this is a problem. I think there's probably some clever quotes from some clever guy who said, you know, if we don't, you know, look at history and learn the lesson from history, we are doomed to repeat it. And I think that is what is happening today. We've got nations, secularist nations, or secularized nations like Europe. Pretty much most of the nations, they've given up on their relationship with God, on their concept of God. God is being pushed out of society, just sort of an edge syndrome. And very often the case for this is it's just we need diversity, you know, and there are people coming from different religion to our country, and therefore we cannot really have God as our common denominator. And we need to respect their religions, and therefore we have to push them out. And there's some, or we have to sort of unite everything or come to some consensus. And you get up with some very strange expressions of faith. We've had a woman bishop in Stockholm. I don't know what you call him, bishop press or something. She wanted to have a Qibla in the cathedral. Now, the Qibla is normally some sort of cove. I'm not sure what you call it. It's like some sort of indentation, some point within the mosque, which points to Mecca. So people know exactly where they need to pray to. And they wanted to stick this in the cathedral. And you think, look, woman, you know, you are supposed to be a Christian, and you're supposed to serve a God, who says that there is no other way to come to God than Jesus Christ. And yet, you want to endorse a religion that says that Jesus didn't really die on the cross, but God was, or Allah was, tricking everybody, and somebody else died instead of him. So that is what the religion says. And at that point, I mean, that woman has betrayed the faith. And I mean, we shouldn't call her a bishop or anything. We shouldn't call her a Christian, because what she is doing is anti-Christian. The same as Islam, Christianity has an exclusive claim to the truth. And if you start, and I mean, it doesn't mean you have to go to war or anything. And from a Christian perspective, we don't, okay? We just present the truth, and you either accept it or reject it. If you reject it, we take our sandals off and we wipe the dust off our sandals as a witness against you, and we leave you alone. That is Christianity. Obviously, other religions have got a different approach. They have to behead you or kill you or dominate you or make you pay for their cause, and then, you know, other religions, again, they just leave you alone. I mean, Buddhism, they don't care what you do. Hinduism, you can worship anything you want. What else have we got? We've got Zoroastrianism. I'm not quite sure. I've never really gone into it, and I don't think it's a religious force to be reckoned with today, and so on. But the point is, and going back to the original point, is we abandon our Christian heritage. We are making ourselves open to tyranny. And this is one of the lessons we've learned in history. And this is what is happening today. We are seeing it in America, where the 50%, they hate anything to do with religions. They want to, or Christianity in particular, they want to get rid of the Ten Commandments from public buildings. They want to you know, destroy any Christian influence in society, and the argument is the separation of church and state. So you're not allowed to say anything. And I was, I remember sort of when I was talking to some guys in South Dakota that some of the kids were talking about God on school premises and they got reprimanded for it. Anyway, the parents got quite ballistic. And I mean, I understand the church and state, but obviously, you know, talking about God doesn't mean that you are, you know, doing it, first of all, in a public function if you're a student. And it doesn't mean that, you know, as soon as you enter a public land or publicly owned land, you're not allowed to say anything about religion. You still got the right to free speech. And this is what the parents were making. But it sort of illustrates that something like this would have been unheard of about a generation ago, just a generation ago. You know, nobody would have stopped anybody talking about Christ. And on the contrary, people would have been quite accommodating. I find the same here in England as well about a generation ago. You know, people were very open. If you were a Christian and you were coming into a school or, you know, you were welcome, you could do this. And people were very tolerant and open. And this tolerance, for some strange reason, has gone out of the window, especially as far as Christianity or Orthodox Christianity is concerned. If you are non-Christian, you can, you know, everything is okay. If you are a Christian, you've got a problem. Okay, so what we did is we did a couple of talks, and I'm going to maybe have one talk after this where I look at globalism. And the talk is, you know, take God out of the equation in your nation and you'll end up in tyranny. Yeah, and we had a look at Hitler and Stalin. We had a look at Mao Zedong, and we can see that there was a disaster on a massive scale, resulting in almost a genocide within the nation. Obviously, we've got a genocide in Germany. I mean, people always quote the figure of 6 million Jews that died. But it's not just Jews. There are lots of other people who died as well. Christians died as well. Nobody ever talks about it. It's quite interesting. Nobody ever talks about the Christians who were persecuted and who died within the Nazi regime. There are lots of other groups of people groups as well who were persecuted, including political people groups as well. Then obviously we've got the you know, the massive slaughter ongoing, you know, going east and in Europe as well. Stalin, we have got figures which are maybe a quarter of his own population which he murdered for no reason, just to you know, these people are dissenters. They don't follow his line. They are a threat to his position. So he had this regime of terror and fear, and he got away with it till the day he died. In I think it was 1953, and the terror he instilled in people was so high that partly, I mean, he had a stroke, and they could have done something about it, given him some medication. But his bodyguards didn't dare to enter his room. Even though he didn't get out. And so they were waiting. I mean, he had a stroke. He was just couldn't move. He was lying on his side, couldn't speak. And they didn't enter the room until well in the evening, as far as I understand. So it's many hours after, by the time the damage had been done. And that pretty much led to his death. Yeah. Considering what he has done to other people and what he caused to happen in his nation, it is probably just a very light punishment what he went through when nobody came to help him because of his, you know, the terror he instilled himself into the people around him. I want to look at another person today, and it's a so-called it's a guy. Yeah, he just a teacher, and he wanted to create utopia. He was born in 1927. 1925, and he was in a nation of 10 million people, and by the time he was finished, one-fifth of the people were dead, so 2 million people were dead. And he, benevolent guy, you know, a teacher, a very humble guy as well. Sort of when he rose to power, nobody really knew who he was. He just stood in the background, and he was directing everything from the background. So there was no, you know, look at me and worship me kind of thing. What we found with Stalin and Hitler, where you had pictures of those, and Mao Zedong as well, pictures of these guys all over the place. And these guys were considered to be their leader, yeah, and their god. There was nothing like that with Pol. The person I'm talking about is Pol Pot in Cambodia. There was nothing like that with him. He was a humble guy. He went actually to a Buddhist, and he was a Buddhist, yeah, but he also went to a Christian school, so he had quite some exposure to both religions. I think the school was a Catholic school, so I'm not quite sure how much he understood of the gospel, but he certainly would have had some exposure. Yeah? I mean, bearing in mind that a lot of the doctrines within Catholicism, if they are taught rightly, they're actually not that far away from a biblical concept. So, for example, the doctrines of the Trinity and things like that. They're very, very close to the way Protestants would understand it from a Bible. Okay, what was the situation in Cambodia? We had the royal family, they were corrupt. They were considered to be puppets to the French rulers. Cambodia was a French colony. And so that was the backdrop. Yeah. So we are looking in the post-war era, and we've got Cambodia. You know, used to be a colony, a French colony. Suddenly, it was independent. So the French installed some royal family, and everything, you know, was there. So, right, what happens when Pol Pot was 24 years old? He went to Paris. And he studied in Paris, and he had like little groups as well, you know, of other Cambodians, and they discussed a lot about communism, and they got this idea of utopia and you know, everybody being equal, which again is all good on the surface, but it was all based on a godless a concept, a system without God. So he, in 1952, he started sort of, doing some attacks against the monarchy. And, in 1956, he worked as a teacher for history at a high school in, I think it was in Phnom Penh. So that's the capital of Cambodia. So we get like a little bit of a rundown of this guy, Pol Pot. So it's just an ordinary guy, you know. He's got lots of opportunity. He goes to France. He studies, being 25 years old. I think he was born in 1925, so which I said earlier. So by the time he was in his mid-20s, you know, very formative years, he has had a really good education, very bright guy, was considered to be one of the brightest students, and he was together with the brightest students. And then he ends up as a history teacher for, in Cambodia in 1956. So whilst he's there, sort of in hiding, he's got some safe houses, and he starts building up some sort of communist party in Cambodia. So that is as opposition to the ruling regime. Okay, so time goes on. He's 38 years old, and so he's still a teacher, but he's at the same time a revolutionary as well. So he tries to get the revolution going. So anyway, the king realized what was going on, and I think it's called Skonik, the king, and he did a purge. And when this purge happened, he had to fear for his life, and Pol Pot had to run away, and he left Phnom Penh, so he went into the countryside. So then time goes on, we've got the mid-60s now, and we've got North Vietnam and the whole Vietnam War going on, and Cambodia got affected as well. I think some of the Americans, when they tried to bomb the Viet Cong, many of them fled into Cambodia, and there was near the border on the Cambodian side a lot of activity from the North Vietnamese. King Sanyok was deposed by a military coup in 1970. So again, so we've got the 60s, Vietnam War, then Vietnam War comes to an end, and then we've got the 1970s, and we've got a military coup by a guy called Lan Nol, and that is when Pol Pot is rising. So by the time he should be, let's have a look, 2030s, in his 40s, so he would be in his 40s. So anyway, when this happens and Lan Nol takes over Cambodia with a military government, he has got the Khmer Rouge, and the Khmer Rouge is born. Rouge stands for red, and Khmer, I'm not sure, I think it's a title for the Cambodians, the people, they call themselves Khmer. And then we get some really weird stuff going on. Sihanouk, the king, was being deposed, allied himself with Pol Pot. Pol Pot created some sort of army in the countryside. And I think Lan Nol, the military government, was more or less focused on the capital, on Phnom Penh. Again, Phnom Penh, I think at the time, had about 2 million people living there. So that's pretty much a quarter or fifth of the population were living in the capital. How much time have you got? I'm just running through historically so you can see, get a little bit of an idea of, you know, what is happening and how suddenly we've got one of the most vicious regimes in place who are just a gang of murderous people and killing people on an industrial scale. Anyway, what was happening sort of towards the 70s that... the U.S. Army started bombing villages near the border because of the Viet Cong thing. And when this happened, about 1 million people tried to take refuge in Phnom Penh. The U.S. Army left in 1975 in Cambodia, and then this war was over. And then again, the Khmer Rouge became more... and more important. On April 70s, Khmer Rouge, they took Phnom Penh, and initially they were all celebrated, you know, this is great, you know, freedom, liberation, no more war, we've got all these crazy military guys out, we've now got one of our own guys there. And here comes sort of the madness coming in, and this is where tyranny comes in. So there's one guy, and this is this... Pol Pot, yeah, he had this vision of a utopia, and in his mind, city is bad, countryside is good. So city dwellers are really bad, countryside is really good. So what he decided to do is to just clear out 2 million people in Phnom Penh. So once he had conquered the city, he forced everybody to go into the countryside and to work the soil. So everybody had to go back to his roots to become a farmer. And you kind of think, what is going on? You know, is this guy mad? And the obvious answer is, yes, he is. Yeah. He has risen to power, military power. He's pretty much controlling the roost. Everybody listens to him. And he has got absolute power. And I'm sure you've heard the saying that absolute power corrupts absolutely. Yeah. And he then forces about 2 million people plus 1 million who fled to the capital to go back into the countryside. And anybody who was left in Phnom Penh, I assume, would have been under martial law, would have been shot at any one time. So people had to leave the city. Right. I mean, I'm sure the peasants in the countryside, they were happy when suddenly 2 million people descend on them and you know, wanting something to eat. Everybody was staying was shot, yeah, and this was a utopia for Pol Pot. Pol Pot at the time was 50 years old when all this happened, and he dreamt of an agricultural society, so he tried to enforce it on everybody. Anything modern was impure. Modern ideas were considered to be a threat, so anything which was modern had to be gotten rid of, and everybody had to go back to the traditional living like hundreds of years ago. The next thing is, you know, anybody who was an intellectual, Pol Pot considered to be a threat, and he started killing them off. So people who could pose a threat to him, so the simple people, according to Pol Pot, you know, the farmers, the peasants, those who till the land and plow and, you know, plant crops and so on, they were left alone initially, and he was just killing everybody who was an intellectual, any artist, anybody who was religious. Anybody who didn't fit in with this utopian vision. So ordinary Cambodians were put into labor camps and pretty much like concentration camps, and they died. And we are looking at the 70s now. Yeah? The family was outlawed. It's quite interesting as well. So the whole concept of family was outlawed. So people had to live in communal lifestyles. Kids had to be brought up in in communal setups. And I was once reading The Principles of Communism by Friedrich Engels, and that is pretty much what he described, you know, the way society should run. Needless to say, he didn't do it himself. He was an industrialist himself. Okay, then it goes over, you know, that close associates started getting arrested. So anybody, you know, who was coming close to Pol Pot in power, was within the power structure of Cambodia, got arrested. Then we've got, you know, the usual stuff, torture, murder of perceived enemies. Yeah? So if you were considered to be an enemy, you were tortured and then eventually murdered. So in 1977, Pol Pot revealed himself. It's quite interesting as well. So we've got 1975, we've got all these years before. Nobody really knew who this Pol Pot was. In 1977, Pol Pot revealed himself, and I was watching a documentary, and there were some brothers of Pol Pot, and they couldn't believe that it was their brother who was actually this great, in inverted commas, leader in Cambodia. So how does it go on? And it's quite interesting as well. We had this all over the place. So we've got a couple of years of his reign. So we're not talking like 10, 20 years. We're just talking about 2, 3, 4 years. And he had this vision of, you know, utopia in agriculture, and everybody should work the land and sing songs and be happy. And then within a short time, people began to starve. There was no more food left. And then, obviously, you had the people with the guns and you had the people without the guns. So the people with the guns took the food from the people who didn't have guns. And so people who were producing food began to die away and starve. Very, very crazy when you look at this. But where have you seen this before? We've seen this in China. Mao comes to power, people haven't got anything to eat anymore because of decisions he made. So there were man-made famines. We've got it with Stalin. You know, Stalin comes to power, and we got the bread basket of Europe, which is the Ukraine. And within a few years, because Stalin didn't really like the Ukrainians, he was a Georgian himself, and he thought those Ukrainian farmers, they are too rich and too cocky. So he's gonna give them some of his own. And millions of people starved in the Ukraine. And the NKVD came, stole all the bread, stole everything they had to feed the people in the city, and didn't give them enough to survive. And even from a, you know, from just basic logic, you know, if you can do simple math and you can add 2 and 2 together, and you know it makes 4 and not 5, and you multiply 2 and 2, and you come up with the same conclusion, it's 4 and not 8 or 17 or whatever. You know, if you have people who produce food and you use the food for people who don't produce food, like for people who live in the city, but then you don't feed these people who produce the food, you're going to have a big problem on your hands. You're going to die because they won't produce food the next year around. And this is what was happening in the Soviet Union. So suddenly there was a scarcity of bread, a scarcity of food. And it was all because one guy didn't like the, I think they called them, there was a Malukan, Malaks or something. Anyway, the rich farmers in the Ukraine. And so there was a man-made starvation in the Soviet Union. Crazy, absolutely crazy. And it just beckons belief what these guys do and what they get up to. Anyway, Pol Pot had a good charisma. He was quietly spoken and seemingly a kind man. That's what everybody said. Interestingly as well, when people met Hitler, people who've met him personally, they said that he was a really kind and quiet and quietly spoken man, and he wasn't quite as smart as what everybody makes him out to be. They call him like a very gentle character and so on. These are people on the inner circle from Hitler. Stalin, I'm not so sure. People were very much afraid of them. He had some close friends. They were singing his praises on him. There was one bodyguard who was writing a lot about his personal moments, and there was a softness in him, in Stalin as well, according to him. Mao similar, yeah, but the same with this leader as well. So it's just all fakery. There's a guy who is guilty of killing 1/5 of the population, and people think that he was a great man, yeah, that he's quietly spoken and has got a good charisma. In 1978, Vietnam invaded. They closed down all the labor camps. No Cambodian family was not affected by all this. And in the 1980s, Cambodian civilians. Let me see. I've made some notes here. I can't read my own notes, but. In 1992, King Sanyuk took over again. 1997, Khmer Rouge were de facto finished. Pol Pot was extremely paranoid, so he started executing close friends as well. And in the end, they had a short trial of Pol Pot. And in 1998, a year later, he died of natural causes, yeah, and unrepentant as well. And so that was, you know, the story of Pol Pot and him just pretty much killing half his nation. We are coming to an end here. Now, what am I sort of trying to get across here? It's just, you take God out of the equation, you abandon God, and your nation is on a very dangerous path to tyranny. Let me just repeat this. Exclude God from your nation. Don't worship him. Don't acknowledge him. And your nation is on a very dangerous, on a slippery road down to tyranny. And tyranny seems to be the result of it all. We could go through the French Revolution of what was happening there and you know, what happened with Napoleon, that he is pretty much the product of the French Revolution. I'm not saying what the kings did before was right and was good. I mean, there was a lot of madness going on. The same with the Tsarist regime. The way the structures were in Russia wasn't necessarily the best, and it certainly required some reform in some way or another. But the big problem is you exclude God from it all, and you end up with something many times worse than what you had before. It reminds me of the story of, you know, Jesus said about the demon once he's driven out and then the house is swept clean and he comes better back with 7 demons worse than him to make home in that house. So if you don't fill an empty house with God, you have got a big problem. And there's a great danger of tyranny hitting you. Okay, what is the moral of this story, and what am I trying to gain to? Number one is really pray for your nation, pray for your leaders, pray for God to come back into the equation, and also push for this as well. Also, repent on behalf of your nations, you know. Go before God and confess the sins of your nation if you can do this, and seek the face of God on behalf of the nation where you are living, and try to obviously preach the gospel and reach out to other people. I think we are living in very perilous times, and we have seen in the 20th century that some very bad elements were in society, and they always ended up the same way. They always ended up, you know, great ideas, great vision, the move towards a utopia, you know, the place where everybody can live in peace. And we end up with a big fraction of the population being murdered, being dead. We know the Bible talks about the last great dictator, and things are going to be many times worse. Okay, we need to pray. Lord, just help us to understand what is going on in our nations and help us to pray rightly for the people in our nations. We pray, Lord, that you will give us wisdom, that you will give us understanding, and that you will give us a passion and a burden to pray for our nations. In Jesus' name, amen.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to the Christian War Room with host Michael Sean Bourne. For more information on how you can participate or find out more about the Christian War Room, simply go to ChristianWarRoom.com. That's ChristianWarRoom.com.